We made this.
Welcome back, everybody, to the X-Cast. As ever, the truth is in here. I'm your host for this episode, Carl Sweeney, and thank you very much for joining me for this discussion of the 14th episode of Season 7 of The X-Files, which is none other than Thief. And I'm delighted to be joined by two guests on this one. First of all, my fellow co-showrunner, Kurt North. Kurt, how are you doing?
I'm okay. I'm tired. I won't go into the reasons why, but yeah. I'm a bit grumpy, and it might show in this episode. We'll see.
I was going to ask you how season 7 of the X-Cast is treating you so far. I mean, it's been Signs and Wonders was your last episode, wasn't it?
Signs and Wonders, yeah. Real enjoyed that with Michael. It was a really decent episode. I've been speaking a lot about Millennium, so it's been really interesting. As I said at the beginning of the season, I know we're halfway through now, so or even further than that. But yeah, it's been good. I've enjoyed looking at season 7, like I said, with a different viewpoint and trying to reappraise it and looking at it from different angles. And yeah, so far, so good.
Yeah, and I think we noticed, because at the beginning of the season, me, you and Sarah, we tried to work out who would host what and keep it relatively fair and spread out. And we realised that we'd kind of messed that up, didn't we? Because there was a massive gap between you hosting Signs and Wonders and then you were going to reappear on Brand X at the end of the season.
Yeah.
So I was thinking like, no, we can't do that. He's got to earn his keep. He's got to be back on an episode before that. So that's why you're here. I've dragged you in for this one. No, it's great to have you back with me and also to be joined by Clara Cook. Hi, Clara.
Hello.
How is life treating you these days, Clara?
Good. I'm kind of tired too, actually. So Kurt and I are in good company. You know, I feel being tired sort of fits in with what we're going to talk about as well. Like, you know, I mean, maybe someone's got a poppet of us somewhere and there's like giving it a pounding. I'm good. I'm fine. I'm actually delighted to be podcasting with both of you again. I don't think it's been a long time since I think we were all on the same podcast. I think that was years ago now. So.
Yeah, it was an episode that didn't even air.
Yeah, I was about to say I probably shouldn't bring this up.
It's fine. Like, it's fine.
Recordings of stuff that didn't ever make it to an audience.
It wasn't for the X-Cast, I should say. It was for a different podcast.
But it was a wonderful episode. It just was one of those ones that's lost to the archives.
So. Yeah.
I'm actually really warm today, and maybe that's in keeping with the episode, because I hope I don't start to sweat as we're sat here talking. But as we learn in Thief, stinky's good. So... maybe that's part of it. Anyway, enough frivolity. Clara, I was just going to start by asking you your general feelings really on season 7, because we haven't spoken to you this season. Do you like it? Do you think it's a good season? What the highlights or the lowlights that jump out for you? What would you say?
Season 7 is an odd season for me because it's not one that immediately jumps to my mind when I think about my favourite season of The X-Files. When I think about my favourite season of The X-Files, I think about like 4 or 5. And season 6 seems like a season where there's a lot of like funny sort of episodes in it. But I guess season 7 is where a lot of the mythology starts to go in different directions, doesn't it? I mean, the mythology develops over the entire series, but season 7 is where it starts to really go in different directions. It feels a little bit like season 7, it gets kind of deflated at the end, you know, it sort of kind of feels like it loses steam towards the end of the season and the later episodes. And I think that is something that is reflected in like the acting of David Duchovny, because I think he was probably wanting a break, wasn't he, really? That's what we sort of are aware of now. So it's not my favorite season. However, there's a lot of it's a season for shippers, because obviously Mulder and Scully are like basically starting a relationship in the season, although I guess people could argue about that, couldn't they? But it's definitely, I felt like they were sort of running out of steam a little bit in this season, even the writers, and maybe this episode we're going to talk about today sort of shows that. It's still enjoyable to watch if you're a fan, but I don't think it's got the same pull as the earlier seasons for new viewers or for even just a general audience who aren't necessarily X-Files fans.
What do you make of that, Kurt? Because I remember you saying on an earlier episode, I think it was when we were doing The Amazing Mellini, but you were saying how a lot of the early episodes of season 7 are just kind of there. you know, yeah. They don't really stand out. But do you feel like when we get to this part of the season, generally speaking, things have picked up a bit, or do you kind of go along with what Clara's saying?
I mean, I would say this season as a whole, it's in, as I say, with reappraising, I'm just for Clara's benefit, I find season 6 and season 8 is the probably the two, one of my two best seasons for me. So season 7 seems to get lost in that. And I found, as I say, the just straight kind of mediocre to average good episodes. Nothing really stands out until we get to like the closure and Xenozeitz and things like that. But I wouldn't necessarily say the back end of the season. I do like the likes of NME and All Things and just Sweat Requiem and Hollywood AD. So I think there is good at the back end of season 7. I just find that overall there just really isn't anything that kind of properly stands out for me. That, you know, that all of them, X-Files, whatever, for me, are always going to be, you know, there or thereabouts as a great season of television in general. But from X-Files standards and what we know it can do, season 7 just isn't there for me. And I'm finding that more and more as we get through to the middle or to the end of the season.
That's interesting, isn't it? Because I think on season 6 on the podcast, you were reevaluating stuff like Trevor and things like that. And I thought, well, he's going to find the same in season 7 with some of these standalones. And it hasn't been the case, has it?
It hasn't. There has been, as I say, Signs and Wonders was the last one I was on. I found that was probably the one I've most reappraised. Rush was all right. You know, it was definitely better than I remembered. But yeah, it's not had the Trevor effect, if I'm going to call it that. But this episode coming up does have some shipping forecast in it. So
yes.
So I'm sure we'll talk about my shipping forecast for this season, which is... Yeah. Now become a thing all because of Mr. Darren Mooney, but Kathy of course latched onto that, but never mind, that's for late when we get into the deep dive anyway.
Yeah. Kurt doing the shipping forecast has become a segment, Clara. I'm still trying to make Kurt Reed's fanfic become a thing, but it hasn't happened yet. Yeah, let's move on to discuss Thief then, which, like I said, the 14th episode of the season, written by the triumvirate of Vince Gilligan, John Scheiben and Frank Spotnitz, and directed by Kim Manners. And this one first aired in March 2000. Yeah, Clara, just broadly speaking, what do you make of this episode and what would you give it out of 10? I should say, first of all, sorry, Clara, is that this, of course, is the episode where Billy Drago plays Aurel Petey, who is, you know, he's committing all this hexcraft stuff to go after Dr. Weeder, played by James Morrison. But yeah, Clara, what do you make of this episode?
So I think it's good that you mention him because I think Aurel Petey is basically the part of this episode that elevates it above a simple just like plodding storyline. His casting and his acting is really, really good. And we should also point out that he's the father of the actor who played Bernard in Monday.
Yeah.
And I kind of, now I can really see it. They both got that sort of twitchy, nervous, kind of creepy energy. I mean, I'm sure it's just their acting, not how they actually are in real life. But like, I was like, oh yeah, I can see the resemblance. But I think that's what elevates it. I also think the actor who plays Robert Weeder is also very good. So they have these two strong male actors opposite each other, kind of opposite ends of the sort of spectrum, from like sort of folk and science, folk magic, yeah. and sort of like mysticism, and then actual sort of medical science. And that's what makes this episode better than just a simple plotting story. I think the story and the actual sort of writing of the events, I think, is what's the problem. I think some of the plotting is the problem of the episode, not so much the ideas behind it. I would probably give it a 7 out of 10 because I enjoyed it and I do enjoy rewatching it, but I can't say it's an episode that I remember fondly. Like if someone was going to say, you know, talk to me about the X-Files, what's your favourite episode, or what are the episodes that, you know, are really good to watch, I wouldn't mention this one.
Yeah, I think that's fair. It'd be a long time before you brought up Thief in that kind of casual discussion, wouldn't it? I think. Yeah, no, I definitely agree. Kurt, what about you? Because we've had a few quick conversations off air this week, and I'm getting the vague sense that you resent me for having made you do this episode. I thought you would like it more. Anyway, how much do you like it and what would you give it?
As you alluded to, I think you thought this was going to be a Trevor, We've got Chimera later in this season, which I'm not on, but I have reappraised that in years gone by because we've discussed that, you know, years back, and I really enjoyed that second time round. I think this episode is okay. I think it's as Clara says, some of the plotting's a bit all over the place. I think I actually don't think his acting's great. I can't understand half of what he says, if I'm being honest. And I don't think it's necessarily his acting. I just think of what he's given to do. I don't feels there. I think it doesn't pull me in by any stretch of the imagination. There's no real the threat and the fear is not really there for me. There's two moments which I really enjoy. I remember the microwave scene. I actually do remember that when I saw it. I went, oh, I remember this bit. The shipping element is the best part of the episode, and I never thought I'd ever say that on any X-File whatsoever. It's a strange one. I've watched it three times this week. I even watched Cape Fear, Carl. Right?
So, I know, I gave you some homework, didn't I? I said, go and watch Cape Fear. We'll talk about why. But yeah.
I even watched Cape Fear, and I rewatched it, and I still didn't connect with this episode. So I'm having to give this my second worst rating of any 10-13 production, and I'm going to give it a 4.5 out of 10.
Oh my goodness, that's
low.
And I thought I could rely on you to deliver a 6 out of 10 at least.
Yeah, well, as you know, 6 out of 10 is generally my go-to. Yeah. I think I've been umming and ahhing over the next last couple of days what to give it, and again, I don't do that. But I wouldn't, unless I'm doing a proper full-on rewatch, I wouldn't go back to this episode. And yeah,
I think
that,
that's fair.
To go to this episode, it would have to be a 5. So I thought, I'm going to have to go lower than a 5. So it has to be 4.5 out of 10.
So that's your lowest for any 10-13, but that's the lowest ever X-Files score, isn't it? Because the other one is a Millennium episode, isn't it?
What? The other one is a Millennium episode,
so
yeah.
You think this is the worst episode of the X-Files?
No, because it's the only one I've ever rated. Yeah, so yes, there's a lot worse episodes than in the X-Files.
Yeah, I was about to say, there are episodes of the X-Files which I would rate like a 2.
Yeah.
But no, they're not in this season, you know. I mean, we're talking about, I think we all know the episodes I'm talking about. But like, yeah, okay. But you haven't necessarily rated those on a podcast, is what you're saying.
No, just what I've podcasted in 10-13, what I've podcasted on, yeah.
I mean, I can understand some of the things you're saying, but I'm more on Clara's team on this one. I'm a 7 out of 10 also. I like this episode a fair bit, to be honest. What I don't think is, I don't think this is a hidden masterpiece or anything like that, because I think you've got some quite promising like raw materials here that it doesn't do enough interesting things with. And I think we can discuss what I mean by that as we go along. Part of that, it's interesting that you single out the shipping, and Clara didn't mention Mulder and Scully at all. Part of what I think is that I don't think they find enough interesting things for Mulder and Scully to do or to talk about. I do think there are things that make this a good episode. I think it's very well directed by Kim Manners, particularly the horror sort of set pieces. I think James Morrison is very good as the Doctor. I have mixed. I'm kind of in between the both of you on Billy Drago, which we can discuss. But it sets up some interesting dichotomies, doesn't it? So you've got the idea of like modern medicine against hexcraft, being prosperous and urban against being poor and rural, being sophisticated against being unsophisticated, high status versus low status. You know, you got this idealized family of the Doctor going up against the idea of having a family member leave home and then being tragically killed. So the problem for me is, and this is what I think holds the episode back, it doesn't find enough fascinating little wrinkles on these things to really elevate it. For me, this episode works on one level only. It's quite a grisly, nasty X-File. It's only really effective on that level for me. That's why I'm only a 7. I remembered liking this one a bit more than I actually do on reflection this week. And I'm wondering if some of the things I'm going to critique about it are a result of the fact that apparently this script was written quite quickly over the Christmas holidays, over 1999-2000. Another script had fallen through, and Gilligan, Shipley and Spotnitz had to work on this one in fairly short order. So, Clara, does it feel kind of thrown together, you know, patched together to you? Do you get that vibe from it?
Yes, definitely. And I also believe that the actors had very little time to prepare. And so I think isn't Kim Manners like quoted as saying something like, none of us had any idea what we were doing. So we all just went to work and tried our best. And one of the reasons why the episode is actually at least kind of coherent is because of the editing. And it's actually Kim Manners editing the episode well, and the editors, obviously, that actually have made a piece of television that we can kind of understand and follow, which makes me wonder how, or the makes me wonder how bad the raw material was initially, or how like incoherent a lot of it was. Yeah, so it's not just that the writers wrote it kind of last minute, and they threw a lot of, like you say, threw a lot of ideas together that kind of some aren't really, well, most of them aren't really properly developed. But it's also that I feel like the people actually acting and doing the production were also having to do it last minute. So, and for that reason, I actually think, you know, I think it's pretty impressive what they produced if they didn't have much time. I guess the thing is the audience never knows that. The audience never sees what goes on behind the scenes. So if the finished product doesn't appeal to the audience, regardless of how hard it was to make, it doesn't matter how hard everyone worked on it. If it, you know, if it doesn't chime with the audience, then it doesn't matter like how hard everyone worked on it.
Yeah. Kurt, what do you reckon now that we've said that about the production reality of it? Did you sense any of that, or can you see that in hindsight?
I can sense that. You can definitely see it now that that's been said, and I wasn't aware of that. But there seems to be... It's a few drafts away from where it would like to be. I think the ideas are all there, and actually some of the ideas are really quite smart and are interesting. But when you've got the likes of James Morrison, who is a great actor, there, then that helps you. And I just think overall there just doesn't seem to be it's that building of tension that, you know, that kind of wanes it down for me. And I think that without having the drafts or really kind of focusing on what the issues are. And now, having said that, the production, as you say, the Kim Manners stuff and things like that are what make it solid. So it's got a good foundation, but that's what, as you say, the one level, that's what it feels like. It's got a foundation. It's just not built upon on top of it. And I think, from what you've said there, it makes sense that that's that it's not really a cohesive story in that way.
Yeah. All right. So before we break it down in depth, I'm going to do my Bruce Forsyth impression, and I'm going to ask you to guess for the score that this got on IMDb, and we'll go higher or lower after the first person has guessed. So, Clara, what do you think the IMDb voting public would have gone for with Thief to the nearest decimal place?
I don't think it would have been quite as low as Kurt gave it. Maybe like 6 out of 10?
6.0 out of 10. Okay. Kurt, are you higher or lower than a 6? And remember, you get nothing for a pen, not in this game.
it's definitely higher because thanks of like Tesla's Dos Bichos probably got 6.4. So
what?
No, I don't know if it did. I'm just saying it probably
did.
The worst ones are generally like a 6 point something.
Yeah.
I wouldn't necessarily say that. Looking at the Facebook group, if I'm being honest, I seem to be an outlier. So I'm going to suggest it might be something like a 7.6.
Ooh, very close. Yeah, you're closest, Kurt. It's 7.5 out of 10.
Okay.
And for the season, that puts it, when you line up all the IMDb scores top to bottom, it puts this one equal 16th. It's tied with Rush, and it's tied with Hollywood AD, which surprised me that Hollywood AD was not higher. I thought that would be more of a fan favourite. But yeah, down the bottom end, that seems a... I wouldn't have it that low, personally.
I worked it out. It was my second bottom.
So, how can it be second bottom in a season with Fight Club and First Person Shooter? Anyway, Clara, what do you think?
I feel like people aren't voting properly. Not that Tara says this at the end of every election that ever happens in the
every
UK.
Democratic event.
I'm like, democracy. It allows stupid people to make bad decisions. No, I am in favour of democracy. Okay, but basically, yeah. I feel like we have 10 points to choose from. Like 10 is a big spectrum. Use the whole spectrum, guys. The whole spectrum. Don't just start. You know, don't just like, you know, start at like get in there at 6. Do you know what I mean? If you don't ever go lower, you can't ever go higher. I feel like use the full range of marks is what I'm saying.
Yeah, that's how I try to like rate an episode on the podcast. But I think what probably happens with something like IMDb is the vast majority of people voting are going to be fans of The X-Files who enjoy watching The X-Files. And apart from the odd, like terrible episode, I think that skews it a bit. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Also, maybe people don't want to mark something low on IMDb because they don't want to be... It's like public. I was thinking, do the writers ever look at IMBD. And they probably don't, but do you know what I mean? Like, I mean, if anybody who worked on this episode was ever going to look at IMBD, I wouldn't want to write a review being like,
yeah,
this was terrible, because I don't want to hurt people's feelings.
Yeah.
Yeah. And as I say, I generally skew, because of the X-Files and because of my like of the show, that I generally skew 6 to 10 anyway. So it's like 6 is like above average. It's all right. I watch it when I need to. Whereas like anything below, it's more like a cliff edge. It kind of just exponentially decreases. So yeah, but that's another story. Yeah. But yeah, I do. It kind of pulls it up because of obviously all the other episodes are kind of pulling up that way. So yeah, so a 6.7 would probably be 6.4, 6.7, I think, is the worst I've seen. It may be slightly lower.
I mean, there's a few episodes that have tempted me to use minus numbers, but I'm not sure I can justify that. But there's one coming up towards the end of this season in particular. Anyway, let's have a closer look at this episode. Let's have a closer look at Thief. Okay, both. So we get the teaser, of course, and we get it's laid on pretty thick, isn't it? Because we've got the opulent house, you know, the elegant attire. They're not only an idealized family, they've just come back from an awards show where he's won Doctor of the Year. And also, you know, there's the idea of one last shot, the last photograph of them as a family all together. So the idealized family being staged for the camera. And he says in the bed, I think this is just a cherry on top, you know, so it's pretty laid on with a trowel. What do you think of this teaser, Clara? Because, of course, it ends with the father-in-law, or the doctor's father-in-law hanging, the word thief written in blood on the wall. Do you think this is an effective start to the episode?
I do think it's an effective start to the episode. I think one of the reasons why it seems a bit funny to us and why we're smiling when we're talking about it is because this is something the X-Files has done before. So though it's an effective start to the episode, it is typical of the X-Files. So we all know where it's going because we watch the X-Files. I think if you hadn't, this was the first episode of the X-Files you'd ever watched, you might be a bit like, ooh, what's going to happen? Mm. The camera focusing in on the actual camera that's taking the photo, you know, and the music, and then also the big shot of the chandelier when they first show the house, and then how successful the doctor is. I mean, successful doctors in the X-Files are almost always 100% doomed. You know, I think we saw this in, wasn't there a successful doctor in like the sixth extinction who also ends up doomed? I mean, it's like, you know, anyone who's of a certain economic class, got a nice big house, and also seems to be doing well, like, you know, they're going to die or something's going to bad's going to happen to them. I feel that there was one very funny moment where I realized that the wife was having a go at the husband for eating her dessert at the awards dinner, which I just want to say is a thing. I've never met a woman whose husband hasn't eaten her dessert.
Well, I think the inverse happens as well in my experience.
But, I mean, yeah, I suppose yeah. It's true, yeah. But we were just talking about this the other day with some friends, and we were like, always eating our desserts. So the thing that I think is really effective, though, is when the doctor goes downstairs, Robert goes downstairs and finds his father-in-law sort of hanging there, and then turns him around and slips on the blood on the floor. The slipping of the blood on the floor is always something that creeps me out. And just the level of shock on his face. But I think, and the dirt in the bed, that's kind of creepy. And thief written on the wall in blood is also really sinister. I was kind of surprised that they had such sensitive motion sensors in their house. I mean, that alarm must be tripped all the time if you go get a glass of water in the middle of the night or something. but yeah, it's pretty effective. You know, I mean, it's standard X-Files. It's nothing special.
I liked it. I think it's staged very nicely. I think it does build some suspense. What I was wondering and what I was going to ask you, Kurt, is do you think we needed to get the quick glimpse of Petey that we get in the teaser? Or would it have been better if there was just like an element of mystery, you know, even if it's just for the first few minutes? Because we don't know exactly what's going on yet, but we know essentially that he's behind it. Do you know what I mean? Did you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I do, because I think the way that it's kind of portrayed is that I might be sort of second guessing myself here towards the back end of the episode, is how does he find where they are, and there's an element of like, you know, paranormal in that he managed to get into the house. How's he done that, as well as the voodoo kind of stuff that he's doing, so some of the hexing that he's doing. So whether or not that's an element that they wanted to play on more is a question that I would have with it. So I think having the quick glimpse of him, it's Yeah, it's fine. I think again, had it been with it being as overt as it wants to be with that glimpse, I would have liked to have seen just it played up more rather than just getting this and then pretty much not getting to the X-ray scene later on. It would have been nice to have that layered element into it. With regards to what you were saying with the intro, I think you're right, Clara, with the it's a stock X-Files and it felt very stock to me. I did like the hanging element to it. I thought that was good. And I am, to be fair, Carl, I am glad that you made me watch Cape Fear yesterday, because there is a scene
forced
in there.
You to watch it.
I know, you forced me to watch it. No, you suggested it and I searched for it and I was like, oh, I've got 2 hours spare. But there is a scene in there where he slips up in blood as well. So I don't know. I think you will no doubt allude to that Cape Fear is a kind of a touchstone for the show. So, but yeah, I think it would have been better to play that up more if they were going to go down that route. And again, it feels like a draft. It feels like you've got that element at the beginning and also towards the end, and nothing really in between that kind of gives you that ominous feeling that he's always going to be around.
I mean, we're going to talk about this, but I think at some point they could have explained how Petey's witchcraft or hexcraft works a bit clearer, because does he need to be close to the people? I mean, I just sort of assumed that if he had a poppet, like a voodoo doll, and he was in a different location, he could cause that person pain. But in all the scenes, he's doing this stuff to the poppet while also being within a vicinity of the person, so like not that far away or in the same building. And I just want a throwaway line from that expert that they consult about how, like, this magic, you have to have at least, you have to be in close proximity or at least near to the person in order for it to work, would have solved this issue. Because if this is magic, why is he even in the house? Why can't he just do it from his, like, crappy little rented room in that horrible boarding house? Do you know what I mean? Like, I don't, so I feel that that's a problem.
Yeah, I don't know the answer. I know they do explain that he needed to be close to the source of his power. So he was close to his daughter's body, wasn't he? But whether he needed to be close to the people, I just kind of assumed that he did because he always wanted to be on the scene. But I don't think it was explained, was it, Kurt? So, yeah.
No, it wasn't.
So like I said, I think the teaser's relatively effective. I think there are probably, I'd say, at least 3 really good like set pieces in this episode. It's whether it coheres into much more than that is the issue. But I think they're well done by Kim Manners. And I just wanted to bring up a quote here about him, which I don't think I've mentioned on the podcast before, but there was a very renowned French filmmaker. Okay, going off on a tangent here. There was a very renowned French filmmaker called Alain René. You know, he's associated with the French New Wave movement. So back in the late 50s and 60s, people might know films like Hiroshima Mon Amour, Last Year at Marienbad. Anyway, a very esteemed French director is the point. And he gave a surprising answer in an interview in 2006 when he was talking about who inspired him. And he mentioned Kim Manners. And he said, Manners directed some 50 episodes of The X-Files, and the virtuosity of his shot breakdown technique and of his mise-en-scène and the way in which he treated actors' performances, all of it impressed me. He's the best of the best. I'm not an expert in television series, but in Millennium, The Shield, The Sopranos, 24, and others, I find the cinematic syntax more rich and inventive than in the majority of cinema. So, I mean, there are some broader things there we don't necessarily need to discuss right here, right now, about the status of TV v cinema and that kind of thing. But I love what he says about Kim Manners. And I think in an episode like Thief, like, it's not necessarily that good a script. It's the quality of the direction. And again, it's interesting, like Clara says, that it was done kind of on the hoof in certain ways and made in the editing in other ways. But it's that quality that means there are scenes here that work very well. At the same time, I wonder if another director would have pushed Billy Drago in another direction, because he's creepy, even when it seems like they're trying not to make him creepy in some ways. Like when he's talking about the dog, or when he's giving the landlady like poultice stuff, it's such an oppressive performance that they don't really humanize him. I'm not sure they really get that. Clara, what do you think?
I know what you're saying. He is creepy when he doesn't need to be creepy. But I actually think I was actually okay with that. I mean, I felt like as a character, he was very human. Do you know what I mean? I mean, a lot of the Monster of the Week episodes in the X-Files, not all of them, but some of them, the character, the villains or the monsters aren't, I don't know. They're not, they're more monster-like, they're more supernatural. And I know he was using supernatural magic and everything, but I felt like he was one of those people that I did feel like you could look out of your window and see him standing across the street from your house. I did feel like he was one of those people who, I mean, they facially disfigured him a bit so that he does look unusual. You would, if you saw him in the street, you would notice him because of that. But he did seem like one of those people that could just be living in a rural area that you could come across. Like, he seemed like a human being to me. And I didn't mind his accent, and I also didn't mind the way that he spoke with his language. Like, it sounds, he's almost speaking in kind of almost like a dialect. And I also like the fact that he seems uneducated, and he obviously is uneducated. And they're pitting this very educated doctor opposite this uneducated rural man, but actually he's not dumb. He's clever, and he's clever. I mean, he's outwitting Scully and Mulder and. Kind of. And I like that because I don't know, I think that it was good, the idea that, you know, you don't necessarily have to be of a certain social class, or you'd have to be specifically educated in a specific way, but that you can actually still be, you know, he's a clever, intelligent person, even though he comes from a different kind of background and a different kind of culture. I didn't find him so bad, to be honest. He is creepy,
yeah.
But I also felt like I might be creepy with that landlady. I mean, she was just the nosiest landlady. She was doomed. She was doomed, basically, from the moment she came on the screen. She just couldn't leave him alone. And I actually felt the love that he felt for his daughter. So I know he's the villain, but I felt like that this episode really does show two fathers who passionately love their daughters and are trying to... I mean, obviously, Petey's daughter's dead, but they're trying to... protect their daughters. And so when he's talking about the dog, I sort of thought that was sort of sad. I mean, it's creepy, but it's sad. You know, it's creepy because he's sewing up a voodoo doll.
Yeah, well, no, this is it exactly. I think I never really got to feeling sad for him because his performance is so creepy, and not just that, the way the scenes are shot, they're always shot in quite a disturbing way. So like when he's stood in the doorway with the landlady and his head's tilted and he's like covered in shadow, you know, it meant that for me, it couldn't really override the sense I got of him being like really menacing. So I think he works really well on that level. He is menacing. He is quite eerie. I never really came to see the other sides of him in the way you did, Clara. There were scenes that in theory were providing that, where he talks about the dog, where he gives the landlady the medicine. I was trying to think of a comparison, Kurt, in X-Files terms. And the first one that I thought of was Virgil Encanto in Too Shy, because he has the interactions with the landlady.
Yeah,
And obviously that's a very different type of character because he had to come across as a bit of an erudite charmer, which Petey is not supposed to be. But I don't know, he could have had some kind of folksy charisma in another way, but he doesn't really, does he? What do you think?
No, I think he falls through the cracks of, do you have someone who's devastated about the loss of his daughter and will go to any length to sort of revenge that, and being the slow, menacing, methodical... planned and you know, kind of fastidious, kind of like sort of way of deciding that I'm going to really get to this family and take away what he loves, and it doesn't really land for me. But I see what they're doing. I think the slow menacing thing is what they're trying to go for. And maybe it's just maybe I've just spent too many years in Millennium territory that it doesn't come across as creepy to me, but that just might be my actual viewpoint from that I just
desensitized
completely to it. Whereas like if you had someone like David Nutter doing the direction of it, it might be a lot darker than this, but no, I think, there is. I think it just falls between the cracks of that, and I'd like to see some more onus on the daughter, and you know, even like sort of like to the point where James Morrison's going, "What do you want from me?" kind of thing. We just don't seem to have that kind of grind between the two of them. We have one major scene, and
because it takes a while to develop, doesn't it? I think that's probably why. Yeah.
Did
either of you know what Mulder was talking about with the Dan Quayle joke? I'm wondering if our younger listeners will even get this, or if you're outside the United States. I vaguely knew about this. Clara, you're nodding. You'd heard this before. What can you explain this? Can you contextualize for us?
It was a US politician who misspelt the word potato, which, and basically never lived it down. I can't remember what position he had in politics.
Vice president.
That's kind of terrible that I don't know that, but you know, he, so very senior position in politics. I felt I honestly don't think we should make fun of people for misspelling stuff. Like, I mean, I'm dyslexic. I've misspelled potato numerous times. Potato sounds like it has an E on it, like sometimes. So, and I know it doesn't, but sometimes it does.
Yeah.
I think that I get that we want our politicians to be smart, but I kind of I'm more concerned about their choices and their decisions,
yeah.
Their actions, yeah, than whether or not they misspell a vegetable. but I guess it was a cultural thing, and it was something that would be in the American consciousness. And so that's why Mulder made the joke.
Yeah, he was the vice president to George H.W. Bush, the elder Bush. So I think 1992 was when it became, was when it happened, and it caused a bit of a frenzy is the sense I got from like a media storm.
If only they knew, hey? If only they knew what was going to happen in future years.
Yeah.
Misspelling potato would be the least of their worries.
I agree with you. I think that sometimes, Clara, when I hear politicians interviewed who can't remember figures and that kind of thing. And I think being put on the spot to recall something like that is not the point. You know, it's not necessarily, it's a bit of a gotcha moment, and it shouldn't be sometimes.
Yeah, I'm like that because I can't remember. My boss does it to me all the time. So who have you got in today? I've got no idea. I planned it 3 weeks ago.
Yeah.
You know, it's like I'm 3 weeks ahead. You can ask me who I've got in 3 weeks' time, I can tell you. I can't say what I did 3 weeks ago.
Yeah. So, yeah, it doesn't mean you can't do your job. And
yeah, exactly. Well, exactly, yeah.
I suppose it leads me on to discuss Mulder and Scully's interaction and their use in this episode. Yeah, Clara, what do you make of their function in the episode? Like, did you find it a good use of them?
No. No, there's some good moments. So I think the moment where, I mean, there's a funny moment where Mulder imitates Scully. And I think we should all acknowledge that when he imitates Scully, all he does is make his mouth really small and like make his voice soft. He makes his mouth like really small. I'm like, oh, mouth is not that small, Mulder. But yeah, I love that moment where he does an impression of her. But and I guess I like the idea that she's starting to think a bit more about sort of kind of veering towards more sort of supernatural ideas of how, you know, the crimes could have happened. She's sort of starting to entertain the paranormal in the way that she wasn't before, and it's keeping him guessing, you know, that's kind of sweet. And they're flirtatious a little bit, but I also feel like Mulder and Scully are often inappropriately flirtatious at crime scenes. And I like the bit where she's blind at the end, I suppose. I think that's interesting. The idea of being blind and sort of having to deal with an attacker is also, it's kind of a frightening idea. But they don't really, I don't know, I mean, they talk to an expert and they, you know, she does an autopsy and they talk in a lab, but it's all very standard X-Files sort of plotting. And I don't feel that they offer too much reflection on the themes of the episode. So Scully basically says something at the very end about the doctor, Robert Weider's decision. Right, his decision with Lynette Peedy. But there's no real debate there about ending someone's suffering, the Hippocratic Oath, about whether magic can save people. I mean, I think we know it can't, but like, you know, whether or not belief is important when recovering from life-threatening illnesses as well as medical treatment. There's no, and they don't even really reflect on the crimes that much.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like the idea that somebody could be burnt in an MRI machine. Like, there's no real, I don't know. You don't really know what they think at the end of this.
I completely agree. My issue with it is that they don't really get stuck into the issues raised by this case enough. They could have had a really interesting discussion about the idea of like mainstream medicine against alternative forms of medicine, but they just don't really, do they? I suppose the danger with them, if the writers had them do that, is do they just become mouthpieces for whatever the writers are kind of grappling with that week? But the series is normally very good at having Mulder and Scully have these illuminating discussions on like all sorts of topics. And I think with this one, their relative like positions and backgrounds mean it would have been interesting to hear what they had to say, you know, especially considering what Scully is going to go on to say right at the end of the episode. But no, they just seem a bit too functional for this in this one for me. Like, Kurt, do you agree with that? And you can also give us the shipping forecast as well at this point, maybe.
No, I totally agree. I think it would have been nice for Mulder and Scully to have that conversation. I mean, you've only got to look back at Orison and the conversation they have at the very end of Orison. And there is the benefit of, yeah, we're seeing Scully starting to have these conversations and have these beliefs. it feels like it's just been, right, we'll pepper that into this episode rather than actually being a focus for it. And, you know, there's, you mentioned the MRI scan. It happens and there's like, all right, okay, it somehow happened, but it was working normally. There's no investigation on that. It's just like, oh, well, the wife's died kind of thing. And, yeah, I think the whole concept and, as you say, some of the discussion that they should be having around, you know, the, as I say, the science and the magic and stuff like that isn't happening. You do have elements with Scully where, you know, there would be, you know, the fact that she does go blind and nothing really happens with that. And I just don't, it just doesn't seem to be a connect. There seems to be a distance between it and it's really rather strange. I think the actual, the flirtatious, the moments, keeping me guessing moments were nice. I wouldn't say they're the best thing in the world, but as an episode, as the way I see this episode, it actually elevates it a little bit. And I like the fact that they are playing around a little bit more with their relationship together, and the fact that they are kind of having that discussion amongst themselves on what Scully would do. We've had discussions like that before in the past, but yeah, it was nice. It was a nice bit of levity in the episode to keep it light and to keep it kind of there. But again, it was the best part of the episode for me, whereas in the past it might not have been. The darker elements would have overseen it. Having said that, you know, the MRI scan is probably the most horrific part of the episode. Mm. But yeah, I do think that the peppering of that works, but I would have liked to have seen more.
Yeah, I think that's fair. In terms of like the performances, I think the standout for me was James Morrison as the Doctor. What do you both like associate him with? Because I think, just as a 10-13, well, not even 10-13, but he had starred in Glenn Morgan and James Wong's Space Above and Beyond, which they did for a season when they left The X-Files. And then they brought in several actors to The X-Files for season 4, but they didn't use him. But he gets a role here at season 7. I think he's really good in this role. And Clara, have you seen him in many other things? Do you find him a dependable kind of actor normally?
I can't recall ever seeing him in anything else, but he looks incredibly familiar to me. You know, when you're watching TV and you see an actor and you're like, I know I've seen this guy in something else. I wonder, did I maybe see him in something like 24? Or...
You did, yeah, indeed.
He was very,
okay, so
very,
yeah, so maybe I have seen, yeah, him. Yeah, I'm remembering him from that. But yeah, I thought he did a very good job. But I can't say I have followed his career or no. I know what he did in other things.
No, yeah, 24, as Bill Buchanan is the character in that series. And I think, Kurt, you watched that show as well, like I did. He's really good in that, isn't he? And good performance here, I thought.
Yeah, and he shows up in season 3 of Twin Peaks as well, as the warden.
You know, I completely forgot about that. Yes, that's right.
Yeah. Yeah. But he's also in Millennium. He's in Dead Letters in Millennium. I don't know if you just said that.
No, that's early on though, isn't it? So, season 1. Yeah.
I honestly thought I had a bit of a micro sleep there. Well, it's like, did you say that? Yeah, he's in the third episode of Millennium. Solid actor. 24, as I say, is the one I recognize him from, and it was, as I say, nice to see him in Twin Peaks as well. So, but he's solid actor, and he does a good job. It's unfortunate that in 10-13 he's not in the best episodes. You know, it would have nice to have seen him in something a bit more worthy of his credence. But generally, whenever he comes on screen, he is a presence, and he always is a solid performer.
Just in terms of Billy Drago, who sadly died in 2019, but we talked a bit about him already, but I found this quote where he talks about the episode and he says, "That story still scares me when I watch it. My character used real dolls or puppets from the Appalachians and the Ozarks. I had relatives from there and I know how they worked with the dolls. People living in those hills and mountains didn't have access to medical treatment, so they had witch doctors, quote-unquote, who practiced healing techniques using these dolls. So the ones in the episode aren't props, we got the real thing. Also, the chants and songs my character sings are those that I heard as a little kid when we visited my great-aunt up in the hills." And he says, "I remember we filmed a scene in which PT fixes a magic poultice for his landlady's back. As soon as the director said cut, my back went out. I was in a great deal of discomfort for the rest of the shoot, and on the day we wrapped, the pain suddenly disappeared. Weird, huh? Perhaps we shouldn't have used the real incantations or those puppets. I actually kept one of them, and it's sitting on the mantle of my fireplace as a reminder of that episode." So it's quite interesting, Clara, to think of him drawing on some real experiences for this role, and a bit disquieting in other ways.
Yeah, yeah. I also would never have kept that poppet. I mean, I don't believe in hexcraft, but there is something kind of creepy about it. It creeps you out, right? I mean, I think it's definitely, I think it's unusual as well, I think, to see, because whenever you, in popular culture, when you think about like hexes or curses or magic, people often think about witches and female witches. And so it's nice to see like a male character doing, you know, this kind of cursing and this kind of these sort of chants, like the idea of a hexcraft. I think there's also what's nice about it as well is it seems quite normal. I mean, I know this is the X-Files and it's paranormal and everything, but when they go speak to the expert in that shop, who I wish she had more of a role, and I wish
it was good fun, wasn't it?
I wish she was in previous episodes. She's just very casual about it. Like for some people, hexcraft or this type of magic system of American folklore is basically like an everyday thing for them, I guess, up in the Appalachian Mountains. And there's also a mention that the Oral Petey, refused to have his daughter vaccinated against smallpox.
Polio,
right?
Wasn't it? Polio.
Polio. Yeah. And that I thought was also really interesting. It's the idea that not only is medicine unavailable up in such remote areas, but it's also they're suspicious of modern medicine and modern medication, and that they don't want their children vaccinated, or at least he didn't. And I thought that was a nice little detail to throw in there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it registers differently in 2021 than it would have several years earlier, maybe.
I think what's really interesting, just as a season view, is that we had something very similar with Signs and Wonders, with the churches, that it was actually the kind of the Appalachian church that was the good element, where it was like the well-to-do churchgoers that weren't, or well, not the churchgoers, but the actual reverend. And, you know, how they've come back to that. So that was like more of the religious aspect of it, where this is more about, you know the fact that you do have that medicine versus science. So it's a running theme, which I wouldn't have picked up before. So there is a couple of episodes that do that. And I just find it really interesting that they've brought this up so close to Signs and Wonders.
Mm.
And also that they entertain the idea that maybe he could have saved his daughter. I mean, Scully entertains him, doesn't she?
Although he wasn't on the scene, he wasn't there, was he? So he couldn't have saved her. Like, maybe in theory he could have, but it wasn't like he was going to be able to intervene even if the doctor hadn't have done what he did, which meant that I don't think I really bought that as a big dilemma, really.
But I did like the fact that James Morrison, I can't remember his character's name, sorry, I apologise, the way he was saying, but you weren't there. You know, I actually think that's a good poignant moment in that, because he wasn't there. He wasn't there to make that choice.
Because she had left, hadn't she? It is the kind of, he says, when he's talking, when Billy Drago's doing the thing where he's making the poppy, I think he's talking about the dog, and he sort of is talking to Lynette, isn't he? And he says, you should never have left. So it's kind of interesting to ponder, like, why did she leave? What was she looking for?
Yeah.
What exactly was going on there? But we don't know.
And I guess there's an element of guilt as well, right? You know, when he says, oh, I know, but you weren't there, he sort of stops, doesn't he? Kind of, and then he looks at, shortly after that, he looks at Robert Weeder's daughter, the other daughter. And I felt at that moment he chose not to hurt the daughter. Maybe he always intended to hurt the doctor, but I think he chose not to hurt the daughter. And so maybe there's a level of guilt that he feels.
It doesn't feel like a disinformed choice. I struggled with that, and I'm glad we're talking about that, because he has to put the picture of them inside the doll, but it didn't seem to be. It was almost like it was a premeditated choice that he was going to choose him, not her.
But so then I guess maybe looking at the daughter, I guess maybe because the camera focused on her crying face a little bit too long. So it suggests something. Suggests he's thinking something. He may not be making a choice, but it suggests that maybe he's acknowledging that this daughter is going to be without a father, and he's choosing to hurt her.
So are we saying as well, Carl, that she left and it was on the bus that she left on that actually crashed? Is that what we're
suggesting?
Well,
she was on a bus when it crashed. I don't know if it was on the bus that she left town on. I don't know if it was that clear cut. I'm not sure it was specified, is it? I didn't think that. I just thought it was two separate things. She left, and then at some point she was in the crash. But maybe I'm wrong.
I know. I thought. I just assumed that she was riding a bus in the city. But the fact that she left maybe suggests that she and her father were estranged.
Yeah.
And she was working outside of the community, outside of her, you know, community in the Appalachian Mountains. But then, Yeah, there's something else going on there, isn't there? There's a backstory that we never get, which is kind of a shame, really.
So I think this is maybe a good point, because we're talking about PT going up against the Doctor, and Kurt's already mentioned Cape Fear a couple of times, and it's kind of a weird coincidence here where I was messaging Kurt after I rewatched the episode. I said to Kurt, well, there's some Cape Fear vibes here. I'm sure there are. And then I went on the Wikipedia entry for the episode, and there's a quote from Frank Spotnitz who says, they're going in a different direction, and the story started to evolve into a Cape Fear type of situation. So I was like, okay, so I'm not kind of completely off base here. So I was thinking mainly of the remake from the early 90s, directed by Martin Scorsese. There was an earlier film with Gregory Peck and Robert Mitchum from the 60s. But in the remake, so Robert De Niro plays an ostensibly unsophisticated ex-con, in that case, who goes after this lawyer played by Nick Nolte and harasses the family. And part of what makes that really compelling to me as a film is that you realise that the family is not as perfect as they seem on the surface, and it's De Niro's kind of intervention that serves to bring that to light. Now, by contrast, in Thief, we don't really get any indication that this is anything other than a quote-unquote perfect family, do we? They're very one-note, and I would have welcomed a bit more kind of complexity in that area. Do you know what I mean, Clara? I don't know if you've seen Cape Fear, but do you know what I mean in terms of, like, the family?
Yeah, no, I've seen both films, actually. Yeah, no, there isn't anything wrong with the family. This isn't the daughter's fault. It's not the father-in-law's fault, and it's not the mother's fault. This isn't, and I mean, you could argue that the Doctor himself made a decision out of empathy, really. You know, he was trying to sort of halt a woman's suffering, a woman who was probably going to die anyway because they couldn't save her. So, there's no sort of dark secret to the family. There's no sort of double, two-sided behavior, like, you know, they're the perfect family that everybody loves, but they're also selfish or unkind or trotting on people or making bad decisions or taking money when they shouldn't, or, you know, corrupt, or I guess there's no indication that this wealthy, successful family don't take care of their neighbors, or like they're not creaming money off other people or anything. I mean, it's none of that. It's simply that this doctor made this decision. I guess you could say the doctor made a decision that it was against the Hippocratic Oath, because the Hippocratic Oath is, you know, to do no harm. And he did do harm by ending this woman's life earlier. But then you enter a debate about halting, whether you can halt people's suffering, you know, whether you can make that decision, whether that's a decision playing God. But then that's a conversation we never have, because Mulder and Scully never talk about it.
Yeah, I want to come back to that debate, because I think you're right. Kurt, so I set you the homework of watching Cape Fear. And what do you make of what we said there? And also the fact that in that film, De Niro is like, he's both very menacing, but he's also quite alluring and magnetic. So you see that the women in the family are, he's something of an object of fascination for those women in the film. Like I was saying earlier, in this film, PT is menacing, but for me, not much else. It's a really fun De Niro performance, by the way, for anyone who wants to see the film, because he really goes for it. It's like, you know, chomping on the cigar in the cinema, watching Problem Child and laughing maniacally. And Kurt, what do you make of it?
I think you're right with the it's multifaceted, the film. So whereas, you know, Drago's like sort of character is kind of more, it's one note. And I wouldn't have minded that had you had some nuance with it. So, you know, you do have elements of that, you know, there's a belief system there that the Doctor's completely gone against, but we don't have that, really have that in-depth conversation. And I know Mulder and Scully could have it, but surely you'd have, you know, those to the Doctor and him having that discussion, because there's no, it's all, you've took my daughter. It's like, well, when did I take your daughter? And then he investigates it himself. Where it just would have been nice to have more of that nuance. And as I say, with Cape Fear, it was definitely more a more nuanced performance. You have multitude of different things. You know, the Doctor, had he done this a few times, or had there been other elements which degraded his character to a degree, would have been better. But it's just very much like a much to do. You know, I'm high profile doctor. I do this, I do that, and there's a very tiny chink, but the chink was done because of empathy, and that's the balance, and it just doesn't really hit. But it is an important conversation, and it is an important question to ask. You know, is the decisions doctors make, and was it for the better good of the person? You know, he took the last 20 minutes, he says, doesn't he? So.
Yeah, so she was in a bus crash. She was dying, and to ease her pain, he gave her morphine, which he says took maybe the last 20 minutes of her life. So we don't know if that's accurate, whether he's kind of downplaying it a bit, but let's take him at his word more or less. He says basically it's a fair trade to make for the pain she was in. And obviously what Mulder says is that PT thinks that we'd have robbed him of his family. So this is where I think the episode could be sharper. Sorry, go on, Clara.
Yeah, no, I think oral PT, when he talks to the doctor, sort of implies that, like, well, you forgot her. You know, like, you know, if you remind yourself, you'll remember her. But the doctor never really forgot her. He just didn't know her name was Lynette Peedy. He remembers her. He said to Mulder and Scully, I remember her. Like, he remembers, because this was a young woman who was suffering and died a sad, painful death. So he remembers her. Like, it's not, like, that isn't a, you know, he isn't this, like, sort of powerful, rich doctor who treats his patients like crap. There is a film that I could recommend to you guys if you've ever seen A Killing of a Sacred Deer, which came out a couple of years ago. And that is a similar story in the sense it's about a doctor who makes a decision and does something that later on his family pay for in a supernatural way. It's not hexcraft. Well, I don't know. I guess you can kind of argue maybe. And that's done much more effectively. But in that situation, the doctor really has committed a sin. Whereas here, I think this guy didn't, you know, I mean, he didn't forget this young woman. You know, she wasn't like she was poor and uneducated and unimportant and he just let her die, like oral PD's kind of implying. It's that she was suffering and he tried to end her suffering. He just didn't know who she was.
Yeah. So I haven't seen that film and I'll make a note of that, Clara, because it sounds good. But to go back to the Cape Fear comparison. So in that film, we find out that Nick Nolte, the lawyer, buried a piece of evidence that could have helped his client, De Niro, get away with his crimes. I think in that film, it's a report that the victim was promiscuous.
Yeah.
So that sets up the moral dilemma there, which is like, is this an understandable thing for a lawyer to do in those kind of heightened circumstances or those horrific circumstances, even though he was supposed to zealously defend his client to the best of his ability? And in Thief, I just don't think the waters here are murky enough, because like Scully later says that she would have done the same thing in Weeder's position. I think many audience members will agree. I'm sure there will be some variance of opinion on that and different principles and things. But I think a lot of people will, you know, listen to the facts as presented here and agree. So to me, it would have been better if it was much less clear cut in some way, if there was more of a debate to be had. So I think the episode misses a bit of a trick by not adding some complexity there. Like we've kind of alluded to, there is the implication that Petey's magic might have been able to save Lynette. But that doesn't really come across as strongly as it could have because he wasn't with her at the time, et cetera, et cetera. Kurt, what do you reckon?
Well, do you think that if you'd played it slightly different to the way that Cape Fear played it, that this doctor is the best in his class, that he's that driven that he will do literally anything to be, you know, to get the awards, to do that kind of thing, that would have helped? Because then you're talking about his attitude to work rather than the person. So if he didn't have that empathy, then and you had that kind of the driving force of I need to be the best doctor, I need to do this like X, Y, and Z. I made a medical clinical decision that person wasn't gonna survive for the next 20 minutes. So I decided to help her along there, and it was a bit more clinical in that way. That it, you might have had that more. It would have been a better fit because of that way you still got the element of that there are a family together who are striving to be the best that they can be, but it's to the detriment of others, and that would have been better. I don't feel that as we said, you know, the doctor's kind of, you know, he remembers her, so he remembers the incident. It was, from the sounds of it, was a one off. You know that. You know, he made that decision at that time because he felt it was the best thing to do. And I felt like you could switch it round to do that. Maybe that, you know, he did it purely on a clinical decision. That was exactly what I need to do at that point and have it more of a driving force for that. And I think that would have worked better.
Yeah, I agree with Kurt. Or made it a situation where, you know, he couldn't treat her to the best of his ability because he was drunk. Or some other thing, or that he neglected her as a patient, like Kurt was saying, for some other reason. You know, he decided he wanted to treat somebody who was, I don't know, more important, or I don't know, somebody who he knew, I don't know, and cared more for, or just like, I mean, even a scene, a flashback to him like treating the Jane Doe or whatever and being like, oh, she's just a Jane Doe, who cares, you know. But I think there's no indication of that. The Doctor is a nice person. He's a good person. He wants to help people. I mean, even his daughter says that to Mulder. Like, why would he have any enemies? All he's trying to do is trying to help people.
Yeah.
And his wife, you know, there's no indication that she's not an unfeeling, that she's an unfeeling person. She seems like a very sweet person. His father-in-law seems such a lovely father-in-law. Imagine saying that to your son. I mean, I've met numerous father-in-laws over the years, you know. I mean, some of them are lovely, but you're not always that lucky. Sometimes you have a father-in-law who isn't as nice. I mean, to say, like, I'm so proud of you, and, you know, like, it's a what a picture, and all that sort of stuff. Like, this is a nice family, and so that makes Oral Petey kind of, like, awful, I mean, you know, when really I think we're supposed to feel a level of sympathy with him.
Yeah, even if, like, sort of, the Doctor had, you know, a dark secret in, you know, flashback is probably the best way of going about it, that you saw that decision, and that decision was a harsh decision to make. Like you said, you're potentially choosing someone above another. You know, we know we've had that kind of discussion before. Yeah. So
I think just even the fact that they say it was a bus crash and he says they were overwhelmed or something, or they were swamped with patients. So potentially there you could have done something that, he had to prioritize people with a better chance of survival or something. Maybe that could have been a way to do it. I think there are various ways, but yeah, like I say, I just don't think that, I think it's too clear cut as things stand personally.
And he didn't just give her morphine and kill her. Like he says, you know, I couldn't get fluids in her fast enough. She was bleeding too much. Like it implies that he tried to save her before he gave her morphine, that they did everything they could.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, let's talk about a couple of the distinctive sequences from the episode. I think you mentioned already the popping corn sequence, which you think is an effective set piece. I do as well. The thing that makes me laugh, Clara, is the condescending doctor who's sat there doing his notes while Petey's trying to use the microwave and that kind of thing. But no, this is where the mum's apparently doing better, and he puts the poppet in the microwave as she heads into the MRI machine. So, Clara, it's quite stomach-churning, isn't it, when it all starts to go wrong? And that's even before you get that horrific shot of the body that's pulled out and like burnt to a crisp, you know? So I think that's a good sequence. I like it. I like the nastiness of it.
Yeah, it's a very good sequence. I think all of us have, I mean, I think most people have some experience of something exploding in the microwave. There's this idea, I mean, there's been other things that have been put in the microwave in the X-Files. I think obviously that doll and Chinga was put in the microwave. there's also a popping corn situation going on in Chinga as well. But I think it's also the idea of sort of radiating something is kind of unpleasant. And I also think MRI machines are a very good source of discomfort for an audience. I just think any of the X-Cast listeners who've been in an MRI machine, you know, hold your hand up. It's not a good experience. They're very claustrophobic. They're very loud. And, you know, traditionally, they're quite hard for patients to deal with. So being burnt in an MRI machine is pretty horrific. And it's very, very clever. And I also think Petey's sort of reaction to technology is also quite well done. Like, it's funny. But he also, the awe of, like, oh, a microwave.
Yeah, we actually, in my house, we don't own a microwave anymore. We used to, and then we got rid of it. And I think my daughter would react in a similar way to Petey if she ever saw a microwave, because she hasn't. We haven't had one since she was born. But no, Kurt, you said that's a good scene. One of the highlights of the episode, was it for you?
Yeah, I think it's done really well. I think the editing's really good as well. As you say, if the editing team's done really well with like sort of flicking between the two and, you know, making that connection to fully give the audience. I mean, you know, they're clever enough to understand what's going on, but that's a way that it keeps bouncing backwards and forwards, and it gives the episode a bit more of a push, you know, a bit more of a like, okay, we'll get into something interesting here. And the reveal of the body is obviously kind of really body horror-esque, and, you know, I quite like that. I thought that was done really well. It has memories of like sort of Final Destination with the sunbed kind of stuff that's going on as well, which obviously has a Morgan stamp on it. But yeah, no, I thought it was a really, really good set piece, that. And you know, it as I say, as soon as I got to the moment, because I mostly forgot this episode apart from Petrie was the only kind of memorable thing I remember of Petrie and Hex. But as soon as I got to this bit, I was like, oh, I remember this. So it's a memorable set piece. And I think it's done really effectively, and it's a good part of the episode. And I'd say the editing's done really well.
So what about the final act of the episode then, when the family heads off to the Sequoia National Forest? So again, the Cape Fear comparison is the family goes to the houseboat in the final part of that film to get away from the antagonist, Max Cady. So you get essentially a final act in a new location if they're using that kind of structure. I think it's a pretty good sequence, Clara. There's some really like effective moments. Like, I love the moment when Scully fires at Petey after she's blinded, and like the camera stays on her. We don't know where her shots have gone, and then like his hand reaches out and takes the gun. You know, so I think it's staged well. Did you feel like there was any kind of lack of urgency? I think Kurt had said this to me, but like Mulder arrives and doesn't seem to be, you know, in that big of a hurry. He doesn't quite know what's going on yet, of course. But how did you feel about the whole end of the episode, essentially, the final action?
Well, first of all, why did they go to a cabin in the middle of nowhere? I mean, I know they have to do it for the plot, for the story, but it's one of those stupid decisions that, like, I felt brought me out of the episode. Do you know what I mean? I was, like, in the story, I was watching it, I was invested in the story and the characters, and then it was like, we've put you somewhere safe, and then it's a cabin out in the middle of nowhere in the woods, and I kind of came out of it again, realised I was sitting in London watching it for the X-Cast, and I was like, what? You know, so it kind of, you know, it's one of those situations that doesn't make much sense. And also, I really did like the bit where Scully, like you said, Scully was blinded, and that we don't see Petey right away. We see her, the camera's focused on her, and then we see his hand come out and take the gun. I wish they'd done that for longer. I wish they made more of Scully being blinded, and I wish that they had focused more on her reactions to things, or even just kind of panned to the actual doctor and his daughter seeing Petey and being like, but not shown Petey right away. And I felt that they delayed it, but didn't delay it enough, and that would have been scarier. Yeah, and then we have this like scene, obviously, where they talk to each other, and like we've talked about this before, I don't feel like it's enough really to going on between the two. But you're right, Mulder does this countless times in the X-Files, where he's like, I'm going to leave Scully in a really dangerous situation. And I like to think it's because he thinks she's capable. I like to think it's that, and that she doesn't need to be saved. But sometimes I really do feel like he leaves her in quite a dangerous situation. And, you know, one of these days, like, you know, things, something might not go right, you know, and she might end up in hospital. So, but yeah, it's kind of moving to a slow conclusion, isn't it? And I think they're trying to, that's where you should be really sort of bumping up the drama and bumping up the tension, and I don't feel like it does that.
I think so. There is a story justification for them going to that cabin, in the sense that they think if they remove the family from the proximity to Petey's charm, it will break the power, won't it? But what they don't realize is he's taking the head off the body and is tracking them. So I take the point, though. They could have gone anywhere other than like an isolated cabin in the middle of nowhere. They could have gone somewhere.
Go somewhere where somebody can't carry a body.
Yeah, they could have gone anywhere, really. Yeah.
You know, go to a location, like, I mean, fly. I mean, you can't, how easy would it be to get a body through an airport or something? Do you know what I mean? Like, it's in, like, go to a location where he couldn't actually physically take a body with him.
Yeah. I mean, knowing what we know now with the Cape Fear thing, because they go to Cape Fear, don't they, on the boat, because to get away from him. And he's under the car. But it just screams out to me that they've gone, we need a final act. Well, Cape Fear did this, so we need to do that. That's what it felt like to me. It was a bit controlled there. Now, the Mulder thing. Okay, so Mulder is...
You mentioned this. You brought this up to me. You said, like, it seemed like he wasn't bothered, is what you said, I think. Wasn't it?
Right. So, Mulder's intuition is normally spot on, right? And he knows what's happening here. He's aware of the kind of the hex magic stuff, and he sees that the car's been smashed open. He sees obviously the stuff in there. There's no urgency to get to that cabin. Now, it works in Orison, because Orison, you've got that abstract music in the background. He's cleaning his teeth. He's doing it. Meanwhile, Scully's been viscerally attacked, and the comparison between the two are, you know, quite telling. It's like Mulder, God, listen to what it's telling you, kind of thing. With this, it's just like he arrives at a car, sees a car smashed open. Oh well. I suppose I better walk up to the cabin then. And it's like, oh God, why? There's no. It feels like it needs to ratchet tension up, but it doesn't do it, because it's like, Mulder, you're being stupid. And I don't like his intuition's normally a lot better than that, and it doesn't really fit him in that mold.
Also, Scully leaves her photo FBI ID in the car. And even aside from whether or not your photo can be used as part of some sort of hexcraft ritual, right? Even aside from that, right? Who would suspect that? No police or law enforcement or FBI, nobody in any of those jobs should ever leave photo ID like somewhere where it can be stolen or found. Like, I was a plot hole to me. I mean, I know they had to do it because he had to get a photo of her to make her blind.
Well, my counter argument on that is it was her pass that she normally wears in the FBI. It wasn't her badge.
Oh, okay. I see what you're saying. So
even so,
it wasn't like something that she could use in a legal way. I guess someone could try and use it to get to the FBI building, but we're like far away from that, right?
No, we just write nurse or doctor or something. Like that.
This is my name. Hello, nice to meet you. Yeah. But I felt that also as well, like the way that they find out where PT was staying is also a bit weird. Like, so all this time, are Mulder and Scully not canvassing, or they're not like looking up any records in the city of where Oral PT is? I mean, surely he has to put his name on something at some point. Like, they do so little investigation in this episode. It's almost like they're waiting for something to happen to them.
I think that if the popcorn sequence is really good, and I think it is, I think the tease is good and it does what it sets out to do. I think this final act sometimes does, but doesn't quite follow through on it. So I think there are some nice moments. The one I mentioned with the camera that focuses on Scully, I think it's a good scare. I think like the camera swooping down through the car window is quite effective. I think the longer it goes on, and when you have PT confronting the doctor and so on, it kind of loses a bit for me, to be honest. And then, of course, Scully regains her sight and shoots PT. I had forgotten that he survives, though, because he ends up in a coma, it looks like, doesn't it? So is a sequel potential here? Could we have had like Thief 2, Electric Boogaloo? You know, could he have come back? And I don't think he's a great enough character to warrant a sequel, really. Maybe in a comic or something, but I don't think anyone comes away from this really desperate to see more of PT.
No.
Yeah, I mean, I was like, I think we're done with this story. I think one of the things that sort of popped into my head when I was watching it was, even if somebody is a dangerous criminal, to shoot someone and to put them in a coma or to take their life is quite a big deal. And they do kind of casually walk in, or I think Mulder kind of casually walks into that hospital room where the person he shot, or did Scully shoot him? No, Scully, Mulder shot him.
Scully shoots him because Mulder comes in a bit later, doesn't he, I think?
I thought Mulder shot him. And that's how she can see.
I think Mulder sorted out the poppet, which is why she can see.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay. But I sort of feel like, you know, I mean, there's a guy that you literally put this guy in a coma. I mean, I know he was trying to kill people, but or he did kill people, but I don't know. It's just the whole thing just felt a little bit like, let's have a little discussion over this guy's body and then leave. Like, I don't know. I don't know. You know, I mean, I think neither of them seem perturbed. Maybe I guess Mulder's like, Scully, you continue to surprise me.
Yeah.
It was Scully that shot him after the eyes. Eyes came back. Yeah,
to her, she could see again.
But I guess none of this seems, I mean, even with any of these crimes, you know, neither of them seem perturbed by this, really. I guess Scotty's a little bit like, would I have made the right decision with Lynette Petey? But none of them seem concerned about the hexcraft or anything.
It seems to be the nature of the X-Files in season 7, though, because, I mean, I talked about Millennium, that in Millennium, that we are coming to the end of the world, the apocalypse, 14 hours to go, and they're just wandering around hospitals and stuff. It's just like this season does feel like it's plodding. There's no agency. By the way, this end of the world, or, you know, this person's going to die, or Scully looks like she might be in danger, but I'll just casually walk up. There does seem to be that there's like less agency in this season for some reason.
Yeah.
Before we go into the mailbag and start to wrap up, just finally, like Clara's alluded to there, Kurt, so Scully says she would have made the same call as the doctor, as Dr. Weeder did. And then it seems like she's wondering if PT could have saved her life. At least that's what Mulder speculates, and Scully's expression seems to confirm that, doesn't it? So what are your thoughts on that?
I like it. I like that we're getting an arc of Scully starting to believe. I mean, it's like, as I say, Orison has more of a religious aspect to it, that what was controlling her at the time. And that's a debate that can go on for a century, you know, about who was controlling Scully? Was it Scully herself? Was it herself?
For the killing, you mean?
Yeah, for the killing of Donnie Faster. So we've had that. So there's a good arc that's appearing in season seven for Scully. In newer times, I would have liked to have seen more of that throughout the season. But what we get, considering where we were in 1999, 2000, I think it's good. I would just like to have seen a bit more of it. But it was nice to see. It was a moment I wasn't expecting that we do have Scully sort of thinking about that. And obviously we'll see this in season eight with a particular poignant moment between Doggett and Scully in season eight. So it's a nice kind of build up to that. And obviously things are forced by the end of season seven. So it's nice to see that Scully's starting to get this thing. And we mentioned at the beginning of season six, didn't we, that in the beginning, there's like a hard reset on Scully. So, you know, by the time we get into the mid to late season of seven, that at least they're starting to free her up a little bit more in her belief system, you know. So, and that's really good.
We might pick this up again when we get into the mailbag. So let's head over there right now. Oh, just a few this week on Thief. Tony Black says, I like this one. It feels almost out of place in season seven, given how much of a straightforward throwback to earlier, creepier seasons it is. But I really appreciate the unnerving intensity of Billy Drago, offset by the privilege and tragedy of James Morrison. Those strong two performances anchor it for me, given that David Duchovny and Gillian Anderson, while not bored, coast through. I do kind of wish we had seen more Mulder and Scully on a case episodes like this in the LA years, though. It's pure shot into the vein X-Files is Thief, and they didn't do that enough in the experimental years. Do you feel like it is out of place almost in season seven, Clara? Because I suppose they have done other creepy episodes this season, like Signs and Wonders, like Orison. Kurt's mentioned Millennium as well, which I think is in that vein. Chimera's coming up. So it seems like there is a decent amount of that stuff in this season, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting we draw comparisons to Orison. I feel like Orison is a much better episode. And I think when I'm watching Orison as younger, and even now, I find it much more scary. I think maybe because I find Donnie Faster particularly scary. But I find Orison much more frightening as an episode, and it stays with me longer than Thief does. I actually kind of agree with this. I think maybe Thief might have been better if it had been put earlier in the season. I mean, earlier in the series. Like, in a completely different season, maybe. I don't know. I mean,
do you mean in terms of what? In terms of being shot in Vancouver or something? Or
I mean, not necessarily the location is something that I think bothers me so much, but I don't know. I mean, the episode itself, I just think they needed to explore more of the sort of themes, you know, like you were saying, the sort of the kind of the two men's disgust for each other's practices, like the hexcraft and the modern medicine pitched against each other. That's something like that might have done better earlier in the X-Files when Mulder and Scully were discussing these ideas more, you know, rather than season seven, where I feel like we're going in a different trajectory. But I guess it does work with Scully's sort of willingness to entertain the supernatural now.
Yeah, I think that was mentioned by Karen McKenna, who said, I always thought this episode was really important to Scully's season seven journey as she edged closer and closer to the believer role she'll take on in season eight. So I guess that's what you're kind of alluded to, Kurt, isn't it? When you mention, I guess, things like Badlar in season eight.
Yeah.
Patience, you know, those kind of episodes are playing around with whether she can take on that role effectively, aren't they? And this is kind of a precursor to that.
Yeah.
In some respects.
Yeah. And just going back to Tony's comment that I could see this being in season eight as well, you know, just played a little bit darker, you know, just maybe a bit more of the body horror stuff that would have worked quite well for season eight. You know, even the idea of the Hex and Scully battling between the science and the Hex stuff with Doggett not really understanding where he is in the whole scheme of things. And I would have bought the car scene at the end a bit more if it was John Doggett, a little bit more because he wouldn't necessarily believe that, but he would have maybe have seen more of the cop in him, would have maybe pushed it a bit. But yeah, so I could see it as a precursor to season eight as well, and potentially it could be in season eight. But I think you're spot on with the likes of Chimera, you know, and Orison. Orison's more of an abstract, you know, episode, especially with being Chip Johannesson. But yeah, there is episodes in this season which are peppered throughout. And I think the argument on season six was it was X-Files light and there wasn't that many dark episodes. I mean, we mentioned Trevor before, which was a darker, the actual concept and looking at the screen was darker. So I think there is moments where they're kind of reflecting on what season six was, and season seven does have its moments. So I do think it has a place in season seven. I think there's more to it potentially than what Tony's potentially saying there. But I can see the argument for it being earlier. Yeah. And I can see the argument for being in season eight as well.
Yeah, if it was in season eight, I can kind of imagine Doggett arguing for the Doctor not giving Lynette morphine. Can't you see Doggett making that argument?
Yeah.
Doggett's a bit more black and white in his opinions than Mulder. Whereas I can't see Mulder sort of saying, you know, you shouldn't have given them the morphine. I think Mulder probably would be in favour of ending someone's suffering. Whereas I can see Doggett from like a...
purely sort of legal standpoint.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
I'm not sure. That's interesting.
Not that Doggett's like an empathic character. Mm. He's very empathic. But like, I could see him sort of saying something like, you know, well, you know, doctors don't have the right to play God or something. You know, that's not what we're, you know. I mean, I can see him arguing for that. So actually, it'd probably be a good episode with Doggett and Scully, actually.
Okay, let's do a couple more. So Andrew Levitt says, one of the few regular X-Files cases of season seven that stands out thanks to the great casting and well-written characters of OLPT and Dr. Robert Weider. There's gravitas in the scenario that plays out between them. Manners' direction brings back the dark, creepy atmosphere of classic episodes. And there's some great banter between Mulder and Scully, demonstrating how far they've come in their time working together and their relationship. Although there's some stereotyping in the characters, especially PT, Thief is a solid episode and easily one of the better entries of season seven. Which is interesting considering, like we said, on IMDb, it's down as like 16th place. I wouldn't put it right near the top of my list for season seven. I think it's okay. I think it's solid, but it wouldn't be up there with things like Requiem, X-Cops for me.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't put it up the top of season seven.
No, I wouldn't. I wouldn't put it up the top.
No, we know you would.
But I mean, that's what's great about the mailbags. That's what's great about the X-Files is like people have lots of different views and lots of different opinions and people see different things in the series and get different things from it. So it's quite, that's what's great about the series itself.
Yeah. Let's finish with a comment from Liam Shane Coughlin, who's been leaving us some really good comments in the mailbag recently. It's a fairly long one, but it's good stuff. He says, looking back on the seventh season as a piece of art in context, at this stage, it's curious to see the familiar X-Files tropes laid out in a crepuscular outing, highly reminiscent of the earlier Vancouver-based seasons. The X-Files had by this point evolved its narrative epoch into a variety of storytelling styles, from the romantic comedy to the religious epic and back to the elliptical musings of later mythology episodes. But one thing it should never forget is the original purpose of the show, that Kolchakian iteration that Carter said wanted to create good, scary stories for the Friday night audience. It was this innovation that proved the catalyst for me to fall in love with the show in the first place. Here we have a relatively straight story with dynamite iconography and a peerless central guest cast performance from the always watchable James Morrison. Morrison is an actor who does wounded tragedy perhaps better than anyone bar the superlative Terry O'Quinn. By this stage, and after the heartrending performance in Millennium's Dead Letters, Morrison is an actor who I would happily sit and watch read out the Los Angeles telephone directory. That Thief seems fresh and dynamic by returning to these old school principles says much about how the series has evolved by this point in its run. It is no coincidence that in the post-Duchovny era at the start of the following season, much of the experimentation will initially fall away to allow a more measured and reflective text on this initial creepy anthology show feel. For that reason, Thief remains an entertaining reminder of the X-Files' original purpose and subtly points to where it will be going. So, does anybody know what the word crepuscular means? No, I'm joking. No, I think a very good comment from Liam. I really do appreciate it.
I'm glad you had to read it out. I'm used to reading mailbags anyway. So Liam is determined.
Yeah, no, it's a good comment. I suppose he's saying, Clara, what I think Kurt's kind of alluding to earlier is, you know, about how you can see this as a throwback or as a kind of a look ahead to what's coming down the line, isn't it? So it's kind of intriguingly placed in that respect. Yeah.
Yeah, and also, like he said, it does what the X-Files essentially set out to do as well, which was to give you this Friday night scare. And it does that in numerous ways that the X-Files traditionally does, which is, you know, it takes something that's quite a comfortable idea, a happy family unit, you know, a hospital where you're supposed to feel safe, you know, that kind of thing, you know, a cabin in the woods. And the X-Files does that a lot, doesn't it? It takes areas where we've all been and takes those places that are supposed to be safe environments for us, that we're supposed to feel comfortable, or just everyday environments, you know, where you might spend a lot of your time in certain places like that, and turns them and twists them and makes them ugly and scary. And the Friday night scare is, you know, who is there out there watching you? Who is, you know, coming into your home, and who is, you know, going to hurt you? And I think the introduction of the exotic, creepy, exotic rare diseases in this episode also points to that too. The idea that you could be in a very modern setting and yet you could get like a flesh-eating disease or something is quite a creepy idea.
Okay, I think we should wrap up there, unless anyone has any final thoughts. Well, perhaps I can give you a final hypothetical question. So if somebody comes to you and says, Kurt or Clara, I want to watch The X-Files. I don't want to watch every single episode. Give me a list of the episodes I should be watching. Would you recommend they watch Thief? Like Clara, with a 7 out of 10, that maybe indicates yes, but in other ways, could they skip this one?
Okay, look, so I'm going to say the way that I rate things is obviously different than the way that everyone else rates things. So, I mean, 7 out of 10, I was saying, like, for myself, for enjoyment, I'm not sure I would actually recommend that people watch this. I mean, I would like them to watch the 10 out of 10s first, and I wouldn't give us a 10 out of 10. I probably would recommend a whole host of other episodes. I mean, I'd probably choose, like, a mythology episode, a Monster of the Week episode, and then I don't know, something really weird and left of field like a comedy episode, but I wouldn't choose this one.
Yeah, no, I think this is quite an easy one. Unless they wanted to do not necessarily a full rewatch, but
an abridged watch or something.
If they were doing a lightly abridged watch, maybe it'd be on the list, but it's hard to say. Kurt, what about you?
No,
I'm guessing no.
No.
No. You should have said yes so that I could come back and say, you always keep me guessing.
But, well, that's no, true. That's true.
The trick.
But I will say that, you know, after talking about it, it's creeping closer to a 5, purely for the fact that I might rewatch it at some point in the near future to see what we've discussed, basically. So it's approaching. But yeah, I'll always keep you guessing because Chimera is a good one.
That is a good one. Yeah.
This one is not.
Yeah, no, I'm looking forward to hearing the Chimera episode. None of us are on that podcast, no. But it should be a good listen. All right, let's finish up then for today. So, Clara, do you just want to tell us about your social media presence and what you're up to and that kind of thing?
Yeah, sure. So you can find me on Twitter at ClaraJeanMC. I'm also, you know, there in the XCast Basement Facebook group. So, you know, let us know what you think of this podcast and say hi. I run a podcast about women and gender in film, television and fiction called The Tales We Tell, and you can find that on Spotify, on iTunes, wherever you get your podcasts, and you can also find us on Twitter at The Tales Podcast.
Great, and it was a real pleasure of mine to be on that podcast with you for a recent episode, Clara, discussing the book Women v Hollywood, which I hope people can check out. Whether you've read the book or not, I think people will hopefully enjoy the podcast. Kurt, how about you? You're returning to the Millennium Fray, aren't you, soon with the time
I
now?
I am returning to the Millennium Fray. The 25th anniversary, 26th of October 1996, I think, was the pilot episode. So we're just in the midst of doing a few episodes to celebrate the 25th anniversary. There'll be commentaries. There's an episode I just recorded with a new perspective on the show with somebody who wasn't even born when Millennium ahead. So that was good. I recorded that yesterday. And so you can find that at The Time Is Now. I would like to give my own Twitter handle out, but I'm quite scared that I might get hexed. So, but yeah, it's at R Muldrake. It's R-M-U-L-D-R-A-K-E. And find me on all other host of things. Star Trek Picard's just wrapped filming as well. So you can find me on the Make It So podcast at Jean-Luc Poddard. And then we've just been doing Series 5 of Red Dwarf, and Series 6 will be out in 2022. And you can find that at Shipwrecked and Comatose, which is the Twitter handle at Red Dwarf Pod.
See, everywhere. Yeah. Everywhere. All over the internet. Yeah, great stuff. I'm on Twitter at SickAJSweedy. I'm in the XCast Basement on Facebook. At Movie Palace Pod is my film podcast, mainly about classic films, predominantly Hollywood films. Clara's been on there quite a few times in the past, talking about Westerns and all sorts of things. I'm actually thinking the old Cape Fear could be a fun film to cover at some point.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Maybe I'll do that at some point in the future. So that's me. You can find the XCast, of course, at the X_cast. Find us on Facebook and on Instagram. We're part of the We Made This podcast network, so do search for We Made This on Twitter or find the We Made This website. In a moment, you'll hear a preview of some of the other shows on the We Made This network. But that's all for this episode of the XCast, listeners. Until next time, always remember, trust no one.
Elsewhere on We Made This. Podcast 616, a Marvel Universe podcast.
I definitely noticed that they weren't the actual voice actors. It didn't bother me. It didn't feel strange or anything. I mean, we as viewers have become so accustomed to seeing, you know, Chris Pratt as Star-Lord, or Chadwick Boseman as T'Challa, or Dave Bautista as Drax, that in these instances, when we hear their voices and they don't necessarily match, it's like, oh, wait a second, you know, that's not the right person. But, you know, stepping outside of it for a moment, you know, these are comic book characters. We're introducing the multiverse, right? And now we are introducing all of these tangents of stories that can go in any different kind of direction. So they don't need to be the same actor. They don't need to be the same voice one-to-one, in my mind. And as a fan, I can accept this. I'm okay with that.
The Movie Palace Podcast.
Yeah, is Truffaut somebody you found yourself drawn to over the years? Have you watched, like, a lot of his films?
So, just in terms of, like, French New Wave, I think I've seen more Jean-Luc Godard than I've seen François Truffaut. But I really do love François Truffaut. I love his attention to realism and to small aspects of people's lives. And I love his stories and how character-driven they are. I've seen, like, Shoot the Piano Player, Jules and Jim, which isn't one of my favorites, but I'm trying to appreciate it more.
Shipwrecked and Comatose, a Red Dwarf podcast.
Craig Charles looks cool as Sebastian Doyle. I'd love to look that cool. Oh, bad.
Craig Charles tends to look cool all of the time, though.
Well, true, but he looks more sophisticated cool than Rock-A-Dude with a band cool. And I'm getting old, I want to look sophisticated cool rather than Rock-A-Dude cool.
Craig Charles had apparently said that, you know, it was great to be able to play this version of Lister because that's more like me. I'm the cool guy. which I thought was great.
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This podcast network. The XCast and X-Files podcast was created by Tony Black and is produced and hosted by Carl Sweeney, Sarah Blair and Kurt North.
You can find the podcast on Twitter at the X_cast, on Facebook by typing in the XCast, and in our group, X-Files Basement, the XCast podcast fan group, and on Instagram at the XCast pod.
Don't forget, you can support the show by becoming a member on Patreon. Our patrons get early access to episodes, behind-the-scenes chats with our hosts and a thriving community of X-Files, and other premium interviews and specials. To find out more and subscribe, you can go to patreon.com/thexcast. That's patreon.com/thexcast.
We are also part of the We Made This podcast network, full of popular culture shows, including our Millennium series, The Time Is Now. You can find all of our shows at our website, wemadethispod.com, or via Twitter at wemadethispod.
Thanks for listening and keep watching the skies.